are listening to a podcast from The National.
Wembley was the theatre of nightmares again, as Tottenham failed to put away supposedly inferior opponents. 1-0 to the Arsenal rings out loud around Turf Moor. Everton's woes continue with a thrashing away to Southampton, and we discuss the outstanding performances of some of the starlets of the Premier League. We'll also be speaking to Richard Jolly, who was at the John Smith Stadium to see leaders Manchester City grind out a win against Huddersfield, and at Old Trafford, as Manchester United needed an own goal to see off Brighton. This is the Extra Time Podcast. I'm your host, John Turner. Joining me in the studio this week, Steve Luckings.
Hello, mate.
And Graham Cagle.
Hey, John.
How you guys doing? All good?
Yeah, very well, mate. Very well. Glad the F1's over.
Yeah, good stuff. Good stuff. Right, you say you're all good, Lux, but then we'll get on to... we'll start the topic this week, or the conversation this week, with the topic of Tottenham Hotspur. Another disappointing result at home to Wembley. We thought their sort of Wembley hoodoo, as it were, had kind of gone, particularly with the Champions League result against Real Madrid. But still, there seems to be a few issues there in terms of picking off... Suppose you said supposedly lesser opposition this week. It was West Bromwich Albion.
Yeah, massively. And I think if you take on, the draws against Burnley and Swansea as well, you know, it's just so disappointing. Yeah, and Spurs' title bid was derailed by the defeat to Arsenal last week anyway. But, I mean, it was just such an insipid performance. And against a team that were ripe for the pickings. You know, a West Brom team struggling for results. Without Tony Pulis, Gary Megson in his first game in caretaker charge, you know, Spurs should have absolutely picked them apart and blown them away, and they didn't. West Brom were really well organised, really well drilled, really well set up, sometimes playing with a six-man defence. Matty Phillips, who was nominally the right winger, playing as a right back as Neom tracked Dele Alli inside. And full credit to them, and young Sam Field as well. I know you mentioned the young players who performed in the Premier League. Sam Field put Harry Winks and Christian Eriksen in his pocket. You know, they didn't get a touch of the ball all game. West Brom were well worth their point. Thought Hagazi was superb at the centre of defence. And you know, it just adds to the it's really weird, is it? They're going so well in the Champions League. You know, beat Borussia Dortmund away in midweek, and then to come back to the Premier League and just put it's their poorest performance, not only of the season, but probably for the last 18 months. It really was poor.
What do you put this lack of consistency down to, do you think, Graham, where they are looking incredible in some games, as Steve said, particularly in the Champions League, and then they've got these really insipid performances against, you know, supposedly weaker teams? Why is this happening?
I think it's a funny situation in that, as Steve said, with the Champions League. I don't know if there is being maybe a subconscious push on the Champions League, where being in the group with Real Madrid, there's a bit more of a challenge, and he is trying a little bit more squad rotation, particularly in defence. So I don't know if there's a little bit of that. And sometimes it's just bad luck. Like West Brom's opening goal, there was a very odd look to it, a feel to it.
It was almost like Sanchez overran the ball, almost, wasn't it? I mean, Rondon showed great strength. But in challenging him, it almost seemed like Sanchez run past the ball, and then the ball just trickles past Lloris. It was almost slow motion the way it went into the far corner.
He's been good all season since he's come into the team, hasn't he, Sanchez?
He's been brilliant.
He's allowed a mistake. I mean, it was a strange mistake. And the way he was kind of, you said, Rags seemed to run past the ball, yeah. Then got kind of easily bumped off it by Rondon, and then yet to concede. But even with that goal, Tottenham should still have more than enough to kind of come firing back and blow West Brom away.
Yeah, I mean, like, yeah, Spurs had the majority of possession. And as you say, Davinson Sanchez has been, he's a real, real good defender, really is. I do think they missed Toby Alderweireld, but I don't think that's the reason for this disappointing draw. As I said, Spurs had the majority of possession, but in terms of getting clear shots off on Ben Foster, they just didn't manage it.
I think the one thing about the Premier League, and I think it's something we've said before and I'll say again, the first goal in games is so important in defining matches, because Spurs have been excellent at coming out of the blocks, particularly last season, and really hitting teams hard and not letting them settle and getting that early goal. And particularly at White Hart Lane, you know, you put teams back and you'd have to kind of come out. Like, West Brom, they might be struggling going forward, but they are still a Tony Pulis side. He might not be in charge of them anymore, but they're still a Tony Pulis side. And you had them sort of, as Steve said, like 6 men, and that's not easy to break down. And, no. and Tottenham are kind of maybe victims of their success to a little extent. Like, you know, two or three seasons ago, before Pochettino really took on, Spurs were kind of like, they're a big side, but they were the kind of club you could go to, and if you played well, you fancied your chances. Now it's kind of like going there, trying to hit them on the break, maybe getting a lucky goal and holding on, and the point's not a bad result, because West Brom will be ecstatic for that point
that
they've taken back. And so it's a challenge for Tottenham to adapt to. It's like, because 2 seasons ago when they really pushed Leicester to the title, it was like, brilliant, they've hit it, can they do it again? And they have. But now they've got the challenge of trying to evolve. Teams are kind of trying to work out, okay, Dele sitting deep, Christian sitting deep. There's challenges to it. And sort of like, that's Pochettino's next step, is to try and adapt to this.
It was a good result for Gary Megson, but it doesn't look like he's got any chance of getting the job, even on a longer term basis. Isn't Alan Pardew looks like he's being lined up?
Well, I was going to say, of all the names that we threw up last week, he wasn't on there, was he? But and you raise a really good point in the week. Why is, you know, Pardew is to varying degrees a manager with a good Premier League record. I wouldn't go much further than that. But why is it English teams feel the need to kind of regurgitate these same managers who have been in jobs, lost their jobs, and then go into other jobs? I mean, it could turn out to be a perfect fit. I'm sure they've done their due diligence. But wouldn't it be really nice to see like a completely out of the blue name from within the English system, from within the West Brom system, whatever it is? But Pardew, yeah, I'm not a West Brom fan, but Pardew doesn't inspire me, and I'm sure it doesn't inspire a lot of Baggies fans either.
So there's a point for Tottenham, that was a disappointing point. There's a point for Chelsea, Anfield against Liverpool. That's an okay result for the reigning champions, but probably they probably felt that they could have got the win. If there was one man on the pitch that did deserve the win, that was Eden Hazard. What a fine performance from him. After the game, there was a lot of comparisons between the two respective number 10s, Hazard and Felipe Coutinho, but there was only one winner on that day.
Oh, Hazard was mustard. He was so good in that game. We looked at the Opta stats, didn't we? We thought we were going to find all these superb and telling touches, and there wasn't really many in terms of key passes. I don't even think he touched the ball in the penalty area. But that, stats are like bikinis. They look great, but they don't show you everything, do they? His influence on the game was so high above everybody, every other players, including his direct rivals. You say about maybe Chelsea being disappointed. I don't know. I get the sense that of the two managers, Antonio Conte will be the happiest with a point. I think for Liverpool, when you consider the 3-goal surrender against Sevilla, obviously the surrender against Chelsea as well, that's really worrying for Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool. The fact that they can't in the big games hold on to lead. So I would say Conte and Chelsea would be happy with that point.
Another goal for Mohamed Salah, though. I mean, he just can't stop scoring, despite the fact that our other podcast guest John McCauley thinks that
he needs to improve
his finishing. Top goal scorer in the Premier League. Good stuff.
Was it 15 goals in 20 games across all competitions? You don't get much better, do you?
No, you don't. No. I don't really know what he wants.
Well, he's just very fussy, as our John McCauley. That's all we can say in that one, really.
Exactly. But it's it was another case for another former Chelsea player scoring against them this season, robbed them potentially of more points, as Kevin De Bruyne did earlier in the season. But I mean, fantastic start to the season for Mo Salah, and you kind of wonder where Liverpool would be without him.
Oh no, absolutely. As you kind of say, like, without him, you really do want, and it's been so impressive how quickly he's clicked into this, because maybe on the first day of the season he was a little bit off his game, when he probably could have scored 2 or 3 against Watford and missed some absolute sitters.
And Colts has held that against him ever since.
And since then, he's really kicked on. And as you say, John, without him, you'd really worry about him right now, because Liverpool, as I said, are going through a period of, they can't defend, they're unable to hold on to leads. And as you said, like, Chelsea maybe aren't disappointed to have got the 3 points, but Liverpool were 5 minutes away from winning that game. And so they've got to be furious with the fact that they let another lead slip. And you kind of get the feeling that maybe Manchester United still have sort of delusions of sort of chasing Man City down, but the rest of them are kind of targeting let's just keep going, doing what we're doing, but thinking about the top four situation and just making sure they're there. And if City have a slip, brilliant, but staying in there. But it's got to be 2 points lost for Liverpool ultimately, especially when you're that close to finishing. And like, Klopp's got a lot to think about. And you could, the fact like he was having a rant afterwards about substitutions and stuff and classic managerial diversion tactics rather than addressing the problem at hand, that in the summer he didn't deal with the defence. And to be honest, I think this next transfer window is crucial for him, because if he gets through that and Liverpool still have the same deficiencies at the back, then he's either blind to it or unable to deal with it.
I found his selection very baffling. I mean, to drop Firmino and Sadio Mane for the big game like this. So credit to Daniel Sturridge. I thought he was superb in the game. But that didn't strike a chord with, well, it struck a chord with me as being very odd.
Did he give any reason for it? I mean, Sadio Mane, that's the big front three, isn't it? Mane, yeah. Firmino and Salah. And you would have thought that, regardless of tactics, that is your tactic, isn't it?
I wonder if he thought Mo Salah, Chelsea old boy, Daniel Sturridge, Chelsea old boy, they'll go and do the damage. But I mean, that's whimsical. But it just seemed very baffling. Their front three is their strength. And to not start with them against a massive opponent like Chelsea, just, baffling.
Chelsea's next game, they are at home to Swansea. You'd fancy them to win that, particularly considering Swansea's main goal threat, Tammy Abraham, will be ineligible to face his parent club. But Liverpool's next game is against Stoke City. And now, Stoke aren't quite as big, bad and ugly as perhaps they were under Tony Pulis a few years ago, but this isn't an easy assignment, particularly for a Liverpool side with, clear vulnerabilities.
Yeah, and Stoke have the perfect setup to trouble Liverpool. They have, players who are superb in the air. Ryan Shawcross, wonder if he's thinking of starting Peter Crouch in this game. Got lots of creativity in Shaqiri and Choupo-Moting. It's an ugly game for Liverpool. It's not one they'll fancy.
No, that's a game where, if you offered Klopp 1-0 deflected goal off one of the centre-half's backsides with 2 minutes to go, he'd take it right now and move on to Saturday. You just want to get out, get in, somehow burgle the 3 points and get back out, because
a cold night at Stoke, isn't it? It's the analogy we all use. Who fancies it on a cold night in the Potteries? And I guess we're going to find out. On the other game, Chelsea-Swansea. I mean, Swansea are in massive trouble, I think. Paul Clement is very close to maybe losing his job, I think. They're on such a poor run of form. And like you say, with Tammy Abraham ineligible, where are the goals going to come from?
No, completely. When you think about, it's the results as well they're having, that's the problems.
Is it 7 games without a win?
Yeah. And it's like really sort of beginning. And they've escaped a lot of attention because of all Palace's problems, but it isn't looking great.
But Palace are upwardly mobile now. Yeah, I think completely. They're a point behind them now. So, big trouble.
Two other games this past weekend involving two of the big sort of title-chasing teams, Manchester City and Manchester United. Lux, you spoke to Richard Jolly a little bit earlier on. He obviously covered the games for us. So this is what he had to say.
Okay, joining us on the line now is our Premier League football correspondent, Richard Jolly, who's in Bolton, a very, very cold part of England. Richard, how are you, mate?
Good, thanks, Steve. Good, you?
Yeah, not too bad. A little bit warmer than you, I gather.
I suspect so, yes.
Now, Richard, you covered two games for the National at the weekend. Let's start with Sunday's game at the John Smith Stadium. Manchester City came from behind to beat Huddersfield 2-1. And now, listening to Pep Guardiola after the game, he said that result gave him more satisfaction than any of the, the huge cricket scores they've racked up against the likes of Liverpool and Palace and Stoke City. I guess we've all become accustomed to this champagne brand of football City play under Guardiola this season. But it was often a criticism of them last term that they couldn't win these ugly games and they couldn't figure teams out, inferior opponents when plan A wasn't working. So, from that perspective, I guess it's understandable why this result would please Guardiola so much.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting because when we think of Pep Guardiola, we obviously think of the technical excellence and the quality of the passing and the sense that they can sometimes, when his teams are at their best, they can almost be on another planet. But what he was talking about and what he was thinking about yesterday was very much the traditional elements, in the sense of that was a win that came partly from character, the character of going 1-0 down away from home with a vocal crowd on a cold day, and partly also from the sort of resourcefulness of how to find an answer, which appeals to the intellectual in Guardiola. And it was also a bit of a gambler in the way and in the way that he set about things. With about 10 or 11 minutes to go, he took off Vincent Kompany, one of his two centre-backs. He brings on Gabriel Jesus, another forward. Basically, Nicolas Otamendi is the only centre-back left on the pitch at that point. And that was an incredibly attacking move from Guardiola. And whilst that didn't directly result in the goal, he knew that Huddersfield had a lot of players behind the ball and they were very, very well organised. And he wanted to do something to try and disrupt them. And I think just maybe that helps produce the winner, just because Huddersfield have got something else to think about, and it only takes one momentary lapse in concentration against a team of City's quality to give someone else that little bit of extra room to do something. And I think it's also the case that if you look at City's season, some of the best moments have been in the tightest games. A lot of them have involved Raheem Sterling. But I suspect when Guardiola looks back, some of the moments he has enjoyed most were Sterling's 97th minute winner at Bournemouth, and his equaliser against Everton in about the 82nd minute in the first home game of the season, and then his winner at Huddersfield yesterday. Because these are not necessarily technically perfect goals, and yesterday's was a case.
Yeah, yesterday's definitely wasn't technically perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's a really important goal, and it's people delivering at key times. And Guardiola was very, very clear after the game. He was talking about that is how titles are won. Because you can have a season where, as you say, you rack up cricket scores against some teams, you drop points against the others, and someone who was far more consistent than you wins the title. And Chelsea last season were very, very good and very, very efficient at winning games. And Manchester City have got a lot better at the mechanics of winning games this season.
So, Richard, you touched on the performance of Raheem Sterling, particularly the goals and the important goals that he's popped up with this season, and he was one of a number of young Englishmen who turned in very impressive performances over the weekend, the likes of Sam Field and Will Hughes. And I guess at 22, Raheem Sterling is the kind of elder statesman of that group. But and you can see him maturing, see him progressing under Guardiola, not just the goals, but he's much more accomplished in possession. He makes much better decisions in decisive moments. I'm thinking more of the you know, winning the penalty that led to Sergio Aguero's equaliser. But his progress under Guardiola this season has been immeasurable.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a triumph of coaching, because what you've got with Raheem Sterling, and I think what a lot of people have always seen there, is a great deal of potential. He is very, very quick. He has got a lot of skill. Despite what some people have said about him, I think he has generally had a pretty good attitude towards football during his career. What Guardiola has done is he's getting him making the right runs at the right time. And I think his winner against Feyenoord last week was a real case in point, because it looked pretty simple the way he just ran onto the pass from Ilkay Gundogan and slotted it home. But there's two elements to it. One is that it was a much better finish than some of those we'd have seen from Sterling a couple of years ago. But the other is just that it was that angled run in the inside right channel to beat the defenders. And that, to me, looked like something that Guardiola has really coached into him. And I think Sterling's progress has even surprised Guardiola to some extent. Because I remember in Manuel Pellegrini's reign, he often talked about wanting to get Sterling scoring more goals. And Sterling's first two seasons at City, just like his last two at Liverpool, he remained at the same level. He scored 10 or 11 goals in each of those seasons. Well, here we are in this season. It's not even December, and he's got 12 already. And that is a huge, huge difference. And as Guardiola pointed out after the game at Huddersfield, he's not just scoring goals. He's scoring really important goals. There have been a lot of late goals amongst them, and one or two of those have been irrelevant, like the penalty in the 6-0 against Watford. But most of them have actually had a significance. And that's what you really want from a player, is not just for them to score goals, but score goals when they really win you points. And Raheem Sterling's got some of the most important goals of City's season.
Okay, Richard, let's rewind back to Saturday then, where you were at Old Trafford. Now, Jose Mourinho bemoaned a lack of creativity from his forward players in the 1-0 win over Brighton. But again, if we look back to last season, that's quite easily a game that United would have drawn against inferior opposition. So there's progress on that front, you would say?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one of the things Mourinho's teams have always done over the years is they found a way to win. And that was kind of what deserted them last season when they had those 10 home draws at Old Trafford, which was really unlike a Mourinho team. This season they've got a 100% record at Old Trafford. And yes, it was a very, very fortunate winner. Ashley Young shot looping up off Lewis Duncan, flying past the Brighton goalkeeper Matthew Ryan. But the way United have been going at home, you would have thought that at some stage they would have found a way to get a goal. I mean, it is interesting, the lack of creativity. Ryan only really had one good double save to make and not very much besides. Mourinho, I think he's quite touchy about the fact he's been branded defensive by a lot of people over the years, including Eric Cantona last week, because his team selection, he couldn't really have had a much more attacking team selection there. And he also brought on all of the most attacking substitutes in the forms of Ibrahimovic, Mkhitaryan and then Fellaini towards the end. But United, with the exception of the 4-1 win against Newcastle, haven't really been too creative until since August or September. They've not really looked as good or as fluent or have had such an effective blueprint since Henrik Mkhitaryan lost form. So that's a real challenge for them for the weeks to come, is to get back to looking as sharp as they did before. Because at the start of the season, they had a really nice blend. They had creativity, they had pace on the flanks, they had height, they had goal scorers in form. At the moment, they don't have all of those. But when they've got the number of attacking players of quality that they've got, and when they've got a winning mentality, and when they've got the belief that they're going to score, it does mean that they can play badly and still get that all-important one goal.
And now, what of Ashley Young's revival? As you said, Richard, very fortuitous with the goal. Underused by a succession of managers, he's now a fixture on the left side of United's defence, or in that kind of left wing back slot. Recalled to the England team recently, and one thing I've noticed about him is a real maturity and a real application of attitude in terms of dealing with the defensive side of that role. His ability to deliver quality balls into the box is his forte. That will never abandon him. But it's interesting how he's mirroring the same job that Antonio Valencia, another converted winger, is doing on the opposite flank.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because if you look at Mourinho fullbacks over the years, a lot of them have been selected because essentially they're first and foremost very, very good defenders. I mean, in some cases, they are fullbacks who are centre-backs by trade, if you think of William Gallas during his time at Chelsea. And at the moment, he's got two fullbacks who, for the majority of their careers, were very much seen as wingers. And I think that's one of the things that allows Mourinho to say he's an attacking manager, but it also reflects very, very well on both Young and Valencia for the way that they are doing the defensive half of their jobs. Because if Mourinho thought either of them was a defensive liability, he's not going to pick them just because they're good going forwards. And I think one of the things you've seen with Ashley Young's career at United in recent years is that he has shown the right attitude and he has shown the right application, because he's had times where he has been out of the team. He's had other times when he's been brought in and brought in to do jobs that didn't come naturally to him. I mean, it's Mourinho playing him at fullback now, but go back a couple of years and Louis van Gaal was doing that at times as well. And he responded a lot better to Van Gaal's idiosyncratic, style of management and to his rather unique demands than a lot of United's other players did. So I think it shows great credit to Ashley Young that whatever his manager is asking him to do, he is doing it. And if he wasn't able to play fullback, he probably wouldn't be getting a game at Manchester United anymore. He probably wouldn't even be at Manchester United anymore. But he is, and he could well end up this season with some winners' medals. He might end up in the World Cup squad. And it's a renaissance that I think not too many people saw. And some of those stories are actually quite some of the heartwarming ones and some of the endearing ones. And it does reflect very well on Ashley Young that he has managed to play his way back into Mourinho's plans.
From the Manchester clubs back to the capital, Arsenal got a good win away at Burnley this weekend. Burnley have been, I mean, one of the really impressive teams this year. Their home form is almost as good as it was last year, but they're picking up wins and results away from home now as well. They're a really good, solid team under Sean Dyche. That wasn't an easy assignment for Arsenal. It was perhaps a slightly fortuitous result for Arsene Wenger's men, but a valuable and important 3 points for that side.
Yeah, massively. I think come the end of the season, they'll look back on this result and it could be a massive 3 points. Like you say, Burnley have impressed everyone with their football this season. You know, they've not deviated massively from the blueprint of last season, but they're picking up results and more points along the way. I would say the penalty decision was a little bit soft. I can see why Burnley were a little bit disgruntled with it. But full credit to Arsenal. You know, they dominated large periods of that game. They asked the most telling questions. And, yeah, they come away with 3 points. And like I said, I think come the end of the season, that could be a massive, massive 3 points.
They're right back up in contention for top four again, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. I think they're in the top four now.
Are they in the top four now? Yeah. So. Should have checked the league table.
But you think, like, you can see why Sean Dyche was so frustrated afterwards, because they've played terrific against Arsenal since they've been back in the Premier League. And that's the third successive game where they've conceded a stoppage time goal to them. So whether that's a bad luck versus misfortune, or in this case it was a bit of a soft penalty, but you can see why that sickens Dyche.
Next assignment for Arsenal, Huddersfield Town at home in the week. Again, they should really fancy themselves. I mean, Huddersfield were impressive again this weekend, but Arsenal will fancy their chances of another 3 points, surely.
Yeah, definitely. Like you said, you know, you want winning momentum, and they've got that now. You know, like I said, it was a very impressive performance and result at Turf Moor. I guess Mesut Ozil is a doubt for the game. He travelled up with the squad to Burnley and was then promptly sent back home because he was unwell. And that kind of gave others an opportunity. You know, it was nice to see Jack Wilshere performing in a Premier League game again. It was didn't quite recognise who the shaven-headed number 10 was for them until I took a closer look. But yeah, you know, when you put in performances like that, you want the games to come around quickly again, and Arsenal have got an opportunity to build on their winning momentum.
For Wilshere, Graham, I mean, Arsene Wenger remains a huge fan of his, always has done. Even when he was out on loan last year, he insisted it was just to get game time as he kind of recovered from a series of long-term injuries. Do you kind of see him kind of kicking on now, maybe trying to force his way into that Arsenal team and getting a bit more game time?
I don't mean there's any doubt about the talent. I think it's just all about his body. Can it keep up with it? Because he's had so many injuries, and it's just what you think of how few games he's played in recent years. And he's still very highly regarded because, in hindsight, it probably was a mistake, but Roy Hodgson thought enough of him to try and include him in the squad for Euro 2016, despite the fact he hadn't actually played the game that season. So obviously, he's still hugely highly regarded, and the fact that Arsene has brought him back in, I think he offers, when he's on it, he can really offer something a little bit different to the midfield.
Yeah, he offers something massively. He's a massive upgrade on someone like Granit Xhaka. Like, Xhaka's got one ball, isn't it? We pointed out that diagonal over to the left back. So yeah, Wilshere's got more in his locker than that. Yeah,
particularly when Cazorla's, it seems, indefinitely injured. I mean, no, it's just,
will we ever see him again?
No, that just sounds worse and worse every week. When you read it, Arsene Wenger was talking about it the other week, and it sounds horrendous.
It's just it seems to be the latest in a long line of these mystery injuries that Arsenal footballers can't ever recover from. They even admitted a few years ago with Thomas Rosicky that we don't know what's wrong with him.
What was it Eddie Bajor said to you? You only had to say hello to him and he was out injured for 2 months.
That's it, yeah, exactly. It's a bit mean, isn't it? Burnley are away at Bournemouth in their next game. The way they're going, they could fancy that.
Who, Bournemouth or Burnley?
Burnley.
Yeah, they could do. But I think Bournemouth have turned a corner as well now. You know, Callum Wilson, you know, last week obviously got the hat-trick. Yeah, so that'll be a really good game, actually. It would have been a game maybe that you didn't fancy watching a couple of times over the past few seasons. But yeah, no, I think it'll be an interesting game.
I'll tell you what club most people won't want to be watching at the moment, and particularly their own fans, and that's Everton. Another chastening defeat. This really amuses you, doesn't it?
No, I thought that was a really good intro.
But I mean, you've always never, or you've never really been their biggest fans in terms of a football club, or shall I use a direct quote, a nothing club?
That is exactly what I said.
You can send all correspondence at slackings@thenational.
But do you know what I mean? Everton are one of these teams. They're always going to be a fixture in the top tier, but they're never going to be good enough to win anything, and they're never going to be bad. Well, this season they might be, but they're never going to be bad enough to go down. So they're just a go-nowhere club.
Well, if they keep pulling out performances like they did at St Mary's Stadium, 4-1 defeat against Southampton, another hapless performance, and they could be in danger of going down, particularly if David Unsworth is given any more games in charge. Whatever he was supposed to bring to the table in terms of, you know, knowing the club inside and out and a club stalwart, it hasn't really translated to first team results.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, we talked about Pardew kind of being this kind of regurgitative manager around different clubs, and so in that sense Unsworth was a little bit left field in those terms. Obviously he's, you know, ingrained in the club as a player and on its coaching staff. But I think the thing that bothers me about Unsworth being mentioned for the job, I don't think it would be a terrible appointment, but it's ex-pros saying, oh, he should absolutely get this job because he played for the club. Well, no, I don't think you should just because you play for the club. You know, you got to the top level as a player by hard work, dedication, and you kept at it. And now, as a manager, you shouldn't just walk into Premier League jobs. You need to drop down the leagues, go train on public parks where you've got to avoid, you know, dog mess and kids riding around on bikes. You know what I mean? Like, really, really earn your spurs. Give other lads a lift to training, that kind of thing. Build a reputation as a manager who develops players and plays a good brand of attacking football. And then make the jump up. So I don't think it's Unsworth. It's other people championing him that is bothering me. But certainly the way they're playing, they've been awful so many times this season. And the thing is, they were in this game. They were in it at 1-1. Sigurdsson scored a worldie. Like, you can't beat a shot that goes in off the crossbar, off the post, bounces off the crossbar and then over the line. It was brilliant. But then after that, it just capitulated. The defending was absolutely shambolic. Ashley Williams, I don't know what they have to do to get him playing football again. But they've dropped him from the team. They've brought him back in. Nothing is working. Something is seriously wrong at that club in regards with that defence. The defending was so poor. Southampton scored some very good goals. It was nice to see Charlie Austin recalled, score on the score sheet again. But Ryan Bertrand just had he had an ocean of green to run into from left bank every time he wanted to.
In terms of their next manager, Graham, I mean, of course, Marco Silva's been heavily linked. He's pretty non-committal on all the rumours. I mean, he got a bit bitey this weekend when reporters were constantly asking him about it, and he tried to constantly deflect. But, I mean, they need to sort this situation out sooner or later, don't they, whether it's Marco Silva or someone else?
Oh, no, completely. It's like they've put all their eggs in the basket of this, and Silva's not really helped the situation by clearly making it... But the fact that he hasn't said anything, has it really opened it up to speculation? But it sounds like Watford aren't moving on this, even though a lot of compensation fees are being banded around on what they'd get. And from Watford's point of view, you think, why would they possibly want to give this guy up? Because at the moment, like, they're eighth and they've got a decent shot at, quite frankly, a possible Europa League spot the way the season's beginning to unfold, or getting in the top 10 for the first time in 30 years, which would be, from Silva's point of view, would be an amazing achievement to sort of, yeah, it might not be something to shout about in Portugal, but it would really sort of raise his stock as sort of like, doing this kind of thing. So I'd be surprised if he left now, especially after their win at Newcastle. But I know it's not the most attractive appointment, but I do think Everton right now, considering that defence, you've got to go for Allardyce, quite frankly.
I do, seriously. I agree with you completely. I think Everton are real, real serious trouble, and they need a firefighter. And, you know, who better than Sam Allardyce? Proven track record of rescuing clubs in dire trouble.
If they'd managed to get Marco Silva immediately, like a month ago, then this whole firefighter situation maybe could have been avoided and you wouldn't have to go for a short-term fix like Big Sam. But now the way that the position they are now in, 4 or 5 weeks later, they are now in a situation where Allardyce is probably your best option.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And if I was Marco Silva, there is no way I would be going, I would swap Watford for Everton now. Not for the reasons that I know you're going to point out. But you know, Silva could find himself labelled as someone who not jump ships, but someone who always takes the next best offer. You know, if Watford carry on the way they are, you know, like you said, Graham, if they finish in the top 10, his stock will be so high and he will be able to pick a much better job than Everton, a much better job than Watford. If I was him, I would keep his powder dry. But money talks. If Everton come back in with massive compensation package, a massive war chest for him to spend in January, you know, he'll take it.
Everton's next game's an interesting one, isn't it?
Very interesting. The return of Moyes.
Yeah, they're two teams that are both struggling a bit, but with Moyes going back, I mean, if he ends up winning with West Ham at Goodison Park, I mean, that is going to be interesting, isn't it?
A scenario that you didn't think possible, really, did you, for a few weeks back? But no, it's definitely on the card.
Well, when you think the irony was, like, when he moved on, Everton fans were chirping so much when Martinez, or we were playing this amazing football and away from Moyes. I don't think I remember a Moyes Everton side defending as badly as I've seen, particularly this season. No. They would not be struggling like this whatsoever. And so part of me kind of always, I always felt like Moyes was a bit maligned by Everton fans towards the end of his time there. Like, there's this expectation. Then, as we've kind of seen from Koeman and Martinez, it's harder than it looks.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you can do it for one season and maybe play a bit of great football. But both Martinez deserves a lot of stick for this as well. Like, the malaise in that defence began with him, I think. Koeman kind of got around it because Lukaku had an amazing season. And with Lukaku.
But Williams did as well in his first season there as well. He recruited well. But where's that Ashley Williams now?
True. Completely true.
Next game for Southampton. They've got the hardest away trip in the league. They're away to Man City in the week. I mean, you go there and, I mean, it's a bye week almost, isn't it? You just go there and hope you keep it.
I mean, what is damage limitation? I guess keeping it down to one goal, really, isn't it?
Well, that's it. And City haven't been smashing teams 5-6-7 like they were a couple of months ago. So Southampton can go there and keep the defeat minimal. Then you've got almost like a moral victory there, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, do we think City are going to go the season undefeated in the league?
Yeah.
We do.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
I think they will slip up. Not necessarily against Southampton, but yeah. It's got to the stage now where, like you say, the cricket scores are gone. The champagne football isn't quite as flowing. But, you know, they didn't play badly against Huddersfield at all. Huddersfield played well. But, you know, if any team was going to walk away the victors, it always felt City deserved it just on their possession more than anything. So, you know, they're just an incredibly hard team to stop, aren't they? You know, we all know where their weaknesses is, but sometimes it's just very hard to get at the heart of their defence when they're suffocating you of the ball.
Let's finish the show this week, guys, on highlighting some of the sort of younger players that impressed this weekend. Steve, there's a few that stuck out for you, wasn't there? I mean, you mentioned Sam Fields earlier on. Loftus-Cheek got a goal. It's good to see these young players playing and making good impacts in Premier League football.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel Loftus-Cheek has impressed me more and more the last 3 or 4 weeks. You know, again, Gareth Southgate was maligned for some of the praise that he sent his way during the recent friendlies. But Loftus-Cheek, he's a player that Palace look to get on the ball. They look to get him on the turn, running at goal. He looks a really, really accomplished player. Regular team football is doing wonders for him. And like I said, Sam Field, Eriksen and Winks just weren't in the game. He run his socks off. Another guy who really impressed me was Watford's Will Hughes. Good to see him getting some action. And he scored with his second goal with his second shot on target as well?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, it's been he didn't get in the side initially. He's been kept out of the team for much of the early part of the season. But the fact he's been keeping Robert Pereira out of the team is, you know, a sign of how much Silva rates him. And sort of, it's great to see him sort of click in immediately. Like, he scored against West Ham, he scored here. And, well, he'll be doing well to get a hat-trick of him if he scores against Manchester United.
Don't rule it out.
He's been highly rated for quite a few years. I mean, I base my data on Football Manager, to be honest. He's been Football Manager legend for about 5 or 6 years. But it's good to see him. He's kind of pushed his way through. He had some injury problems before, didn't he, I think?
Yeah.
And now he's come through. I mean, Graham, you're from around that way. You've got lots of Watford friends. How are they expecting all kind of big things of Will Hughes? They're obviously pleased to see him performing.
I think there was a lot of excitement about him in the summer when he first signed. But it was like, because obviously at the end of last season, there was a lot of depression at Watford because of how badly we finished the season under Walter Mazzarri. And quite frankly, the atmosphere felt like more like a relegation than a success, really. But even though they stayed up. But Hughes, as I said, he didn't really sort of start the season in the squad. He was like, I think Silva was pressuring him, you know, to sort of raise his game in from the friendlies and such. And as I said, he's taking his chance and he's coming, which is all you want from the players, sort of like.
Yeah, I mean, to go to Newcastle and win 3-0, that's a terrific result for Watford.
As I said, it's look. And the frightening thing from Watford's point of view, if you think they actually blew a 2-goal lead against Everton last month, just imploded for no. When you look at
who
the rest
does that
season,
against Everton?
No, well when you think of the logically, how well they've defended largely in most of the games, their token result away from home against teams around them has been kind of 2-0 or 3-0. And it was just kind of shows like anything can kind of happen in football. And they were unlucky Gomez got hurt. But if you had those 3 points on, which obviously all team have got hard luck stories, but you had that and the fact that if Richarlison scores that goal against Chelsea with a 2-1 up,
yep,
suddenly they could be third or fourth rather than eighth. And it wouldn't completely misread the season at all. They've been very good against most sides. Defensively, there's still an issue there in that when they come up against good sides, I think United will score a couple at Vicarage Road. And Tottenham, I think they've got on the Saturday as well. Like, that might be where Harry gets his confidence back. I'm definitely, considering the fact that Harry Kane does nothing every time I ever play him as fancy captain, I might even play him triple captain on Saturday against Watford.
Right, chaps, I think that's all we've got time for this week. Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks, mate.
Cheers, dude.
You can find the Extra Time podcast on Apple Podcasts and at thenational.ae/sport. Thanks for listening.